Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Poglent has teamed up with Philips TV to host an exclusive event at Abbey Road Studios. Philips is the official TV partner of the legendary studios, famous as the home of iconic artists from the Beatles and Pink Floyd to Oasis, Sam Smith, Frank Ocean and Brockhampton. And this unique event is your chance to experience the next generation of Philips TVs in the home of cinema sound. And to learn about the new state-of-the-art Philips OLED Plus 984 TV with its immersive Bowers & Wilkins sound system designed to create a movie experience like never before. To find out how to win your place at the event at the end of November, go to www.pocket-lint.com/Philips OLED. Hello, my name is Stuart Miles and welcome to the Pocket Lint podcast. No sooner have we all finally got around to embracing 4K picture resolutions on our TV, and the industry turns its gaze to the next big story in the resolution journey. But should you sit up and pay attention? When are you likely to want to get it? And really, what's the story so far? Pocketlint editor Chris Hall has been finding out and joins me to discuss more. Meanwhile, I've been chatting to up-and-coming band Bamley in their studio in London to find out how they create music and how, in some cases, the process involves AI and not even them at all. And Pocketlint gaming maestro Rick Henderson has been playing with Apple Arcade, with the initial 30-day free trial almost over for the first batch of users that have signed up on day one. Is it worth the monthly subscription fee that they pay? And what are the best games to download? But let's go back to you, Chris. How soon are we all going to be watching 8K, or is it just beyond the realms of all of us at the moment in terms of price?
Okay, so 8K, obviously, if you followed any of the story of TVs, you will know that everything works along in these incremental steps. We went through HD, we went through full HD, then we arrived at 4K. And I remember in about 2012, everybody was saying 4K is irrelevant, we don't need it, there's no content. And here we are, and everybody's been watching 4K for a couple of years because it's fairly easy to get to. Now, the association and everybody involved with 8K, and earlier in the year, the 8K Association, which is the sort of overseeing body that's going to work across the ecosystem to make all this happen, was formed. And I sat down with one of their head executives this week, who said that if you look at the way that these things are progressing, then we should be expecting to see 8K coming along within the next few years. And that's sort of around 3 to 4 years, perhaps, where there's going to be plentiful content. That's the same sort of cycle that we saw moving from full HD to 4K. And now we're going through the same process again. And you have this sort of crossover point where there's suddenly a lot of content. You asked, when are we going to be watching it? The real answer to that is, at the moment, there really is very little native 8K content out there for you to actually watch.
But that doesn't mean I can't go and buy an 8K television, because people like Samsung and others are selling them. So is that something that as their listeners listening in should think, well, okay, if there's no content, should I really buy the TV?
The interesting thing about that is that 8K is an inevitability. You have to accept that you're going to go out and you're going to buy a TV and it will have 8K on it. Whether or not there's 8K content or not is kind of a separate issue. The thing to understand is that if you go out and buy a flagship TV over the next few years, it's very likely that you're going to get an 8K panel on it. There are some people who are pursuing two streams at the moment where they're still producing high-end 4K TVs, but we've seen this introduction and Samsung has kind of taken the lead here. They have a range of TVs that go all the way from 55 up to, I think, 98 inches. They certainly have them at 55, 65, 75 82 inch sizes, so they have a full range.
And then I remember they've even got that. I remember talking to one of the Samsung guys a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, and they've got the wall as well, which is literally a wall. And I know that's there's an 8K version of that. So yeah, you know, really go to the, you know, start building houses out of these
things. I mean, the question of whether you should rush out and buy it depends on how much you want to have the latest and the greatest television, how much money you have to spend, and how regularly you want to replace your TVs. Sensible consumer buying advice at the moment would say, maybe don't go out and buy one of these things yet. Maybe wait until the content is there, because you're not really going to be getting the full capacity of that TV at this very moment. But the other side of the argument is that we're never going to reach that point if people aren't going out and buying these TVs. And that was one of the points that Samsung has made this week, which is that if they're not putting in the work to refine the technologies to make these affordable for customers, then the business never moves forward and it kind of stagnates a little bit. And obviously, the thing that really is driving 8K, the thing that's more important than anything else, is that at the moment, people want to buy bigger TVs. And that's going up and up and up. We used to have, I remember we had a 32-inch TV, then a 40-inch TV. Now I've got a 49-inch TV. You have a TV that is
55 inches.
55 inches. And it's 55 inches that is the average at the moment, I think, in the UK. And the industry is projecting the biggest growth in the 65-inch plus area. So there you can see that once you get up to these much larger sizes and people now want big TVs rather than, you know, that's no longer a vulgar thing, having a massive TV. Now it's what you really, really want in your front room. And that really drives the demand for higher resolutions like 8K. So it's inevitability. It is going to happen. It is going to come down the line. And as we move further along the path towards that happening, panel manufacturing is going to increase. The prices are going to come down and, you know, It's an inevitability. You can't resist it.
Now, the final question I have is, if you go out, say we've convinced someone to go out and buy an 8K TV, they think, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to take the plunge. Can you benefit from, I know a lot of the, when the 4Ks first came out, it was all about upscaling, upgrading, taking 4K content. Is it easy just, do these TVs just say, well, you know, we'll fudge it to a point. It's not pure native 8K, but we can make it look like 8K?
Well, this is where the magic really happens. If you're going to buy into the magic, because everything at the moment is about upscaling and it's about using artificial intelligence to do the upscaling. So it's not just looking at an image and thinking it would probably be better if it was brighter or sharper, or we'll make the skies bluer by adding a filter to the whole thing. That doesn't happen anymore. That's in the back in the dark ages. Now it will look at the image and think about what's going on in this pixel compared to this pixel. And this is probably a blurry line because the resolution is so low. How do I sharpen up this area? That looks like it might be a cup. How can I make that look more like a cup? All of this is happening at amazing pace in the TV as it's going through these references and running these algorithms, these computational algorithms, to say, how can we make this picture look better? And that's really where the magic is at the moment, because obviously you're going to be feeding in content from 720p standards up to 4K that you're streaming off Netflix, and you're throwing it onto a huge 75-inch 8K panel. It's all going to be upscaled. And the real challenge at the moment, or the real competition, is going to be in who manages to upscale it the better. But the good thing is, there's also a range of TVs out there, and it's probably worth mentioning some of the prices if you're interested.
Always, always interested in a supermarket sweep with you, Chris.
Okay, so everybody talks about OLED a lot at the moment, and OLED and 8K added together equals expensive. There aren't a huge number of TVs out there, and if you go to LG, they have a flagship OLED TV, which is 88 inches, I believe. And that will cost you a cool $30,000 or £30,000. Okay. So that's the expensive point. Okay. If you go to Sony, they are offering a flagship LED 85-inch 8K TV, the ZG9. And that costs £14,000 or $13,000. Again.
Wow. Okay.
Yep. Okay. So let's come down to the realistic area. There's the Samsung Q900 range. It's called the Q950 in the UK because Samsung labels things a bit differently. This actually launched in 2018, and this is the TV that really kicked off 8K. They've updated it for this year. And you can get a 75-inch model for about £6,000 or $5,000. Remember that they do come in two sizes smaller than that. So this is where you can get 8K.
It's starting to become affordable.
Yeah, you can get 8K there for under $4,000. So that's where the flagship, people may say, oh, this is a 65 inch TV that I can probably afford to buy. And bear in mind that these are now coming up towards Black Friday sales and things like that. So there may be some deals. You may be able to get one of these things for about £3,000.
Still to come, Rick gives us his opinion on Apple Arcade.
What they were basically saying is that they design games that fit a phone screen perfectly, and then all of a sudden had to think about how it would work on a TV as well.
Up-and-coming foursome Bambly are a relatively new group on the music scene. Backed by the Apple Music-owned A&R label Platoon, they're already making waves with their pop undertones, which are seeped in influences taken from disco, hip-hop and soul. Using elements of DJing in their vibrant live set and production, the band open a world of sample-heavy beats over luscious pads and percussion loops. But what's perhaps different from your average experience is some of those loops and beats are created by AI, with the band sculpting the end experience after the fact. I caught up with three of the four at their studio in London to find out more, and I started by asking them to not only introduce themselves, but how they use tech to create the music they make.
I'll start. I'm Louis. I'm a singer and I play keyboard, and more actually now I'm going to just be dancing because the computer's going to do all the keyboards. I'm not really good at it.
I'm Charlie, I'm the guitar player and producer, I would say.
I'm Tim, I'm a producer as well, and I do a bit of DJing and sound experimentation.
And you play bass too?
Sometimes I play bass.
Tim is probably the most intimately involved with tech.
Yeah. Probably.
So let's start by a nice, real general question. How do you use tech in your music? Because I know you kind of use traditional instruments, but then also you don't.
Yeah.
Tech, I mean, uses us.
Yeah.
From start to finish, really.
Yeah.
We use Logic, the Apple recording software, which is like the home and the sort of centre of everything we do.
It's our canvas. It's where we bang our heads against our technological walls. It's sort of everything. And yeah, no, we've become pretty well versed in it. But, you know, you're constantly learning. You can never fully learn these softwares. And they're constantly changing. And the way that we interface with them is so influenced by their layout. It's a really interesting thing when you look at it. But we just see it second nature now. Which is cool.
And so from an instrument perspective, you use traditional music, so you, drums, guitar, keyboards. Is there anything else that you introduce into it that gives you an edge over a traditional band, so to speak?
Well, that, like, once it's in the realm of Logic, then the, like, possibilities of what you can do to sculpt or reinterpret or change or manipulate that sound kind of become pretty endless. Yeah. Like, as soon as you've imported it into that program, suddenly the possibilities become scarily endless.
Yeah.
So even if you gave two producers the same source material, like the same keyboard or the same drums, put in Logic, you could turn out completely different results.
Yeah. And do you find that can cause problems with focusing on what you want to achieve, because there's so many possibilities?
Definitely.
It's no secret that limitations, like, help in a lot of creative situations.
A four track, you can get a better song.
Yeah.
Debatably, a better, like, composition, because you're just focusing on the guitar and the vocal rather than 250 tracks of soundscapes and synth noises and bass sounds, and they all just make a mess.
Yeah, like, when we're writing a song, we do normally try and stick to keyboard or piano or whatever. And we really try, but a lot of the times we'll be just messing around on Logic. And for example, our next release is called Katata. That came about by just Timmy holding down this chord on an arpeggiator, which is like a synth module, but it's a software one. And it just creates these crazy notes and rhythms, and it just picks out little things. And Tim just, like, got this one bar and just, like, this is it. And then just that one bar from this thing which the computer and Tim together made, like, that was the start of the song. And then we sort of worked the lyrics and the melody around that. So yes, sometimes it really does use you, which is cool.
And so you can find yourself that the software starts creating the music rather than, and you going, oh, okay, that's interesting, rather than,
and you just pick your moment.
Yeah, you're curating it.
Was it generative music?
Yeah.
So you can create systems that create music for you. And Brian Eno
did that.
Yeah, I was going to say, what was it? Reactor? Is that it?
Yeah, I did. I used Max for Live, which is a very confusing world that I don't know much about, but I made this one patch in it. But people use it to create kind of audio devices that can do anything. Like, you can just create your own kind of patch.
Museum soundscape for 5 hours. But it's never the same.
You're a little Frankenstein.
But we did some generative music work where you create a set of rules and systems that the computer has to abide by, and then you kind of just press start and let the computer generate its own music, and every time you press play, there'll be a different result, all based on kind of random number generation. But yeah, so that music, I had nothing really involved in making music other than setting the rules and programming.
Was it good?
Yeah, it sounded right. It sounded a bit weird.
It was good. Yeah.
It was cool.
It was out there. Yeah, left field, but then we can extract some of those things and then put it into pop music or whatever. It comes kind of full circle. And sometimes it starts with that or it ends with that. Like, just recontextualize things.
No rules.
And so, what we've talked about sort of perhaps software influences you and what the computers are making. What kind of influences do you take from a wider field? For someone that hasn't listened to the music, what would you say? Where's the background?
You mean the hardware?
No, I mean the sort of just that sense of what influences you from like other music. What how would you describe your music?
Oh, yeah,
a mishmash of everything.
Yeah.
And that has to do with the technology as well, because we can do whatever we want, and sample whatever we want, and take influences from anything and store it on that computer and make endless amounts of music.
Yeah, I mean, so being like a musician. And when we were starting to make music, it was kind of exactly the same time as like the streaming age sort of coming to fruition. Like, that's definitely had a huge amount of influence over us as music makers, because we of course have the music that we love and we're teenagers, and like that's kind of like our home ground. But like, we listen to endless radio mixes and literally anything. And you kind of, when we're making music, we kind of have to keep it within the realm of writing an accessible song which people are going to understand, which is true to us, but like, take anything from all kinds of types of music, be it like African 80s synths, which sound to one person really crappy, they sound wicked to us. You know, we go to like toy shops and buy little crappy keyboards for like £5, and they're just like the best thing ever.
I love recording like just the objects that are around us, like most of the time for percussion and
sort of like a sound mixer or an engineer in that sense.
Yeah, like
of
Foley, kind of borders Foley at times, where you're like, oh, I don't have a snare drum, but I've got a couple of woks and like a pillow or something. Yeah. You're like, I reckon I could do something.
Pitts is our specialist on that. You'll see him next to a mic just like holding like a champagne glass.
We have fun with the process, and the music comes out quite like a pleasantly spirited, happy way. It's not that we aim to make that. Sometimes we make dark stuff, but it's all quite happy.
Yeah, we tend to keep it kind of like.
And so do you think growing up with the streaming, with, you know, effectively millions of songs at your disposal, has influenced you in that sort of dynamic of wanting to play with everything?
For sure. Having 10,000 tracks on iTunes back when I used iTunes meant I could listen to any era at any point in an instant.
Yeah.
I don't think people had that opportunity 40 years ago, so you'd have 15 records or whatever.
Yeah.
Or the radio.
Yeah, you just a collection of
the radio under your pillow and
collection of cassettes.
They're in the charts. So like, yeah, that's why the influences are very diverse now. And we've taken a lot on. There's a lot to listen to.
And I don't want to say you get crippled by choice, but like the thing with streaming that I certainly felt, when there was like a sort of 4-year period in my musical life where it was just a mess, because I'd find a song and I'd add it to my library. And now I'm like militantly strict with my playlisting. I've got like a whole system, and I feel like it's very easy to get swallowed up by Spotify, and lose the sense of yourself, and you're just listening to what it's suggesting you. And I really hate that about Spotify, particularly Apple Music less so. And so, like, getting into good listening habits by forming playlists and stuff has been another part of, I suppose, becoming a music listener. It's like, it's actually not as easy as it used to be.
Some people get like, you can find yourself getting so wrapped up with the collecting side of listening to music that you kind of forget that you're actually just like listening to music.
Yeah.
Like, I found that song, I put it in my playlist, my song.
Yeah.
But you don't actually really kind of like sit there and like, I don't know, connect with it.
Yeah.
And so as a band, how do you tackle that approach that we now, you know, you talk to people and they're like, I don't know what to listen to. You know, I find it hard to find music. How do you, as a band on these streaming services, having grown up with these streaming services, how do you get through the thousands of songs to become the band that people listen to?
Well, we could talk to each other about a piece of music we find that every day. We kind of don't. We just listen to lots of radio, like DJ mixes and radio mixes a lot of the time. And like once in a while, you'll just find that one where you're like, oh my God, this person's going to hear this. And like we kind of share those like all the time.
As we collaborate.
Yeah.
We all bring different influences together.
Yeah.
And the songs are a product of that. People want to listen to anything. If you ask someone what they listen to today, they're like, everything.
Yeah.
I love it. All of it. Everything. So,
which is great.
Like, we can do that as we want.
Apart from pop music. Everyone is, ooh, pop music.
Yeah. But as a band promoting yourself to listeners,
yeah,
how do you worry that the algorithms and things of Spotify and Apple Music and those it's services so just yeah. will won't yeah. surface your music? How do you go about getting your music out there to listeners for them to say, I want to put it on my playlist or yeah. what have you? Is that do you think that's yeah. harder today?
No, I don't know. I mean, I think we're mindful of that for sure.
Mm.
But I think that's a really good thing to be mindful of because it's easy to get lost in your influences. And I think it's, I don't want to, I'll probably get in trouble for saying this, but like, I think it's maybe quite easy / not lazy, I don't want to use that word, to just make music that you want to hear. I think it's a really great challenge to take the music that you love and put it in a place and put it through a filter where it's like, okay, this isn't just for me or mm-hmm. like for my little corner of where I see myself in culture. It's like, this is for a larger number of people, and streaming's so good for that. Like, Spotify aren't actually really picky about what they're going to pick. I mean, everyone's, what's it called, Discover Weekly, and the release rate and stuff. They have like a real mixture of music in there. And it's a great thing for musicians because it means they don't have to lean towards, oh, we have to sell out, or we always have to have big choruses, we always have to have these sort of like song structures. You don't have to do that anymore.
Yeah.
Like, you just don't.
You don't have to do that, but I feel like now you just need to have the numbers that prove that your song kind of works
yeah.
to Spotify. Like, you need to have a ratio between the amount of listens and the amount of people that have saved your track. And if that ratio is good, like, your music slowly starts climbing the ladder, and if that ratio is not working,
do you worry that could change the music that you create? We talked about the software changing the music you create because it comes up with ideas that you might not have thought about. Are you worried that with that structure that you think, right, well, we want this song, I mean, I'm sure there must be bands out there, I want this song to do well in Spotify, the data suggests that we've got to have a chorus here, we've got to
have a
guitar solo here, we've got to, you know, do this there and stuff. Do you worry that might taint and change the way that you make music?
You just got to be realistic with yourself about that piece of music. Like, it's kind of obvious. Like, for example, we're releasing an EP quite soon, and we don't really want it to be like big chorusy, kind of like hard hitting, in inverted commas, a streaming like EP mixtape thing. We don't really want to be that. We just want to show people what kind of music we make. But like, some of the people we're releasing it with are like, oh, you've got a couple songs that you're not releasing, which could be on this EP because they know they're going to stream better. And it's quite obvious, I think, after releasing a couple of tracks, which ones are going to stream better and which aren't. So we don't tend to worry about the ones that we kind of know might not stream that well, because we know that the fans, or like the heads, as we call them, will probably like those the most, right? Mm. And like our mates are in a band called Juno Dream, and like they've got songs that are chorusy and like more sort of poppy. Their most streamed song is like, they were so shocked about it when they see it's got like 2 minutes.
Yeah, instrumental, like 2 minute. Kind
it's
of
beautiful.
Out. It's really beautiful.
Spotify loved it.
Yeah.
So you never know.
But yeah, it really can surprise you, I think. Like,
yeah.
There are all these formulas and rules that, like, I don't know, like, you don't want an intro more than 5 seconds because people
and so
skip sort of thing.
Do you find that with your own music? That there's some, you know, you must obviously. It's that classic thing, you ask which one's your favourite, you'll probably say, they're all my favourite, you know,
yeah.
because they're like my children or whatever. But it's that, do you find that there are some that have resonated more with certain audiences, maybe through Spotify or maybe through Apple Music or Tidal if you're on there? Or
yeah.
Do you find that simple?
Yeah,
it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, but the French love Hey Raoul.
Yeah.
We've got a song called Hey Raoul, which
yeah.
got on a couple of playlists in France, and now we've got like half of our fans are French, which is great. But yeah. I mean, we've only released four tracks at this, so I suppose it's kind of hard for us to give proper answers to that. But yeah, it's funny seeing it so far.
And in terms of quality, you talk to certain music fans and they're like, it's all about vinyl. It's got to have that sort of, you know, that edge to it or something. There's a cassette reemergence coming back and people enjoying the sort of, you know, the metal tapes they used to have in the 80s and 90s. Obviously, you're producing majority of your work, it sounds, by using computers and therefore you can create it at a sort of a higher quality level. Do you think that people should be listening to it sort of via the, you know, the Amazon Music HD services or the Tidals, you know? Is that an issue or is it just about appreciating the music?
Just enjoy it.
I think we've passed the barrier where the quality can hinder on the enjoyment you derive listening to the song. You know what I mean? Like, once you're part, like after 1965, that recording was good enough and they made it way better, but it didn't make the music any better in my eyes. Like, I don't know, I think we've hit that threshold where you can hear really well, you can enjoy the song, any better it's just like, I don't know how much it contributes to the
phone speaker, you know? Like,
yeah.
Literally, we were finding that iPhone microphones are really, really good to use to like record our vocals. And
we wouldn't get arsy about how people listen to our music because as much as we do take a lot of care and time into how we make our music, how we record it, like we're recording it in here and like in our bedrooms and stuff. And when hopefully down the line we're in studios and we're using, you know, £2,000 microphones, then maybe it'll be like, oh, but you should listen to this on vinyl, like maybe. I think the vinyl thing is like, that's as much the process of playing and connecting with the piece of music, holding the art, and I love that sound of vinyl. I think it's amazing. I think that's why the resurgence has come, kind of the opposite of what we were saying about streaming. You find it hard to connect and you're just collecting all this stuff and you just swamp down. Vinyl's the antithesis of that,
exactly.
Isn't it? Which is great.
Cool, and so I suppose the final question I have is what's next?
For us?
More music?
More music,
EP after Christmas.
Yeah.
Good show on the 25th, the Jago Dalston.
Yeah, we're throwing parties every month, which everyone should come down to. They're a lot of fun, it's like sort of loaded DJs, sort of ranging in stage of their career. We've got Don Lee coming down, who's amazing. We'll be playing live at all of them. And yeah, hopefully that's going to grow into a messy, funny thing.
Apple Arcade is Apple's new gaming service that for one fixed price allows you to download a number of exclusive games to play whenever you want. Rather than simply being an ad-free experience of games already in the Apple Store, Apple has worked closely with games developers to offer games that you perhaps wouldn't have previously thought about playing. Immersive, luscious, and at times very different, this isn't Fortnite or Clash of Clans. But can something more artsy or off the beaten track be compelling enough for you to want to pay and then play? Rick has been delving deeper to find out. So, Rick, you're here with me now. Is it any good?
Yeah, it's actually very, very good indeed. And that's not just coming from me. That's anecdotally as well. I've been talking to quite a few people of both sides of the argument, both gamers and normal people who probably wouldn't normally pick up games.
Those
normal people. And they love it. All of them. The main reason being is because it's all for one set monthly fee of £4.99 or $4.99 in the US. You actually get so many games that you can pick up, play, choose to play. Some are in depth, some are very light and casual, that there will be something for everyone. I think Apple are planning to eventually have a library of over 100 games, but there's definitely more than about 70 on the platform already.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot, isn't there? I mean, one of the questions is, you know, what are your favourite games so far? What should people be, they're thinking about this, what should they be picking up?
Well, that's the beauty, is that there literally is something for everyone. There are arcade games like Sega, like Sonic Team Racing. But the games that have actually caught my eye, funny enough, are more mobile-centric because, you know, things that wouldn't normally work on, say, a console. Mini Motorways is a very good example of that. That's a fantastic puzzle game where you have to keep adding more and more motorways and roads. It's from the person who made Mini Metro before, which, again, funny enough, it's made me go back to Mini Metro and appreciate that game all over again. It's a beautiful game. Another one is Grindstone. It's another puzzle game, and it's kind of like a match game, but you have to carve your way through different enemies that are presented in a grid. It's hard to explain, but it's really addictive and beautiful again. And what is quite nice about that is normally you associate puzzle games with advertising, in-app purchasing, and sort of like barriers where you can't really progress much further unless you pay money. Whereas this obviously is completely and utterly unlocked, so it doesn't feel like you're forced into anything. And I think that's where Apple Arcade really works at its best, is that all of these games, you're not asked to pay for extra levels, you're not asked to pay for any more. Your one subscription fee covers the whole thing. So there's no obligation, really, to play a game to its conclusion if you don't like it. But at the same time, there's no barrier to downloading it in the first place.
And I also think that one of the nicest things is there's no adverts. It's not even the adverts are sensible. It's just there are no, in the games I've been playing on it on the platform, there's no games within the Apple Arcade experience. No adverts in the Apple Arcade experience.
Exactly. That is actually a massive barrier to current, in my opinion, current games on the platform, on sort of like app stores, Android or Apple, is that you're always sort of like sporadically told to watch a video just so that you can progress in the game. And while that is a better system perhaps than loot boxes, it's still not perfect, whereas with Apple Arcade, you don't get that at all. I also like the fact that it has a pick up and play method where it doesn't matter what device you're using, you can actually play it on anything. Like you can play across Mac, Apple TV, iPhone and iPad. So if you're on the tube and you're right in the middle of a big session of Grindstone, for example, and you get back and you suddenly fancy playing a bit on the TV, you can actually just carry on there. One barrier to that is I was chatting to the development team at Us2, who did the wonderful Monument Valley. What they were basically saying is that they design games that fit a phone screen perfectly, and then all of a sudden had to think about how it would work on a TV as well. So they redesigned the game so that it works almost totally differently on a phone and then on a TV. For example, if you put it on your TV or your Mac, it's in horizontal mode, which it isn't on a phone.
Now, you could argue that that's one of the negatives. Are there any other negatives that you found so far with the time that you've been playing?
I'm unimpressed slightly by some of it. To be honest, there are very few negatives, but the one negative that I have found out so far is that there are few games I would say are good for children. When I first heard about Apple Arcade, I always expected it to be a sort of like, and certainly the fact that it has a family sharing subscription base, I expected there to be a lot more games that my 8-year-old daughter, for example, could play. And I don't think there are at the moment. But then Apple has said that we are only in a launch window, and it's the largest ever number of games launched with a brand new platform.
Yeah, I suppose, because the other problem with that is that, you know, it is a very family friendly play because it doesn't have ads. There's no chances for in-app purchases. So, you know, parenting, we're both parents, you know, that's kind of great for me. I think on that said as well, the other thing to add to that, which I found quite frustrating, is that it's iOS 13 only. And yes, that means that anything, I think you have to have a 6S or above to be able to play Apple Arcade from a phone perspective, which kind of wipes out some of the younger children who have got 6s or the 5s or 5s's or whatever. They can't get it either. So there is I think that's, it's going to probably take a year or two before that trickles down and before the 11-year-olds of this world start getting iPhone 7s and above.
Yeah, I do think that is the case. I mean, this is only a launch though to begin with. And it would be nice to see more family-oriented games. It'd be nice. There are some on the horizon. I can't mention them because I have seen them, but I'm not allowed to say as yet.
Oh,
there are more family-based party games coming that genuinely open it up a lot more. And actually, suddenly, you can have one person on an iPhone on a couch, one person on an iPad on the other couch, and one person playing on Apple TV. And that really, that opens it up to be a much bigger, wider thing than casual mobile games.
Well, I suppose it takes that sense of if you've all got iPhones or if you've got, you know, a couple of iPads or whatever in the house, and let's face it, through historical upgrades and all the other stuff, it's probably quite a lot of people. It's suddenly you're not all having to, okay, you could all be in the same in the lounge or whatever, but you're not having to share a quarter of a screen as you do on an Xbox or a PlayStation.
No, exactly. That's a really clever way of utilizing certainly the family sharing plan, which basically you get six people can use it at the same time for the one £4.99 a month fee, which is excellent. That's a really good idea. I also particularly like, and this is something that I've done as well, is because they now have compatibility with the DualShock 4 and the Xbox One controllers, you can actually link them to your device or link them to an Apple TV or a Mac and play using those. And that actually opens it up to possible down the line, even more console-centric games.
Mm, definitely, definitely. So the $4.99 question, you know, for some people who started this at the beginning, or because you got, I think you get 30 days free, don't you, at the moment, do you think you should continue paying? Will you continue paying?
Yes, absolutely. It's very much worth it. The amount of titles that are available is just extraordinary. And the fact that you don't have to sit there plowing through adverts for half the day just to get to the next level is just a groundbreaking, amazing thought. It's also, your money also will go into development of even better games in the future. And there's always going to be something to play. So I can't see that there's any real faults in that.
That's it for this week. If you've enjoyed the show, can you please give us a 5-star rating on the podcast platform you're listening on? It really will help raise our profile and let others know you liked it too. Until next Friday, pip pip. Poggleint has teamed up with Philips TV to host an exclusive event at Abbey Road Studios. Philips is the official TV partner of the legendary studios, famous as the home of iconic artists from the Beatles and Pink Floyd to Oasis, Sam Smith, Frank Ocean and Brockhampton. And this unique event is your chance to experience the next generation of Philips TVs in the home of cinema sound. And to learn about the new state-of-the-art Philips OLED Plus 984 TV with its immersive Bowers & Wilkins sound system designed to create a movie experience like never before. To find out how to win your place at the event at the end of November, go to www.pocket-lint.com/Philips OLED.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.